You know, he just said, look, I think we've got to go save this country. I think you're the guy who can help me in the best way. You can help me govern. You can help me win. You can help me in some of these Midwestern states like Pennsylvania, Michigan, and so forth. And he said, rightfully, that we have been very, very close for a long time, but especially since I endorsed you in 2022. And I would not have won that race without Donald Trump's endorsement. And the president's trust then and his partnership since then has been something I value a great deal.
Republican Ohio Senator and now vice presidential nominee J.D. Vance, in an interview with Fox's Sean Hannity last night, recounting the phone call where former President Donald Trump asked him to join the GOP ticket. Vance has served in elected office for just 18 months. He became a national figure during the 2016 election for his outspoken anti-Trump criticism during the book tour for his best-selling memoir, Hillbilly Elegy. Hannity asked him about that last night, as did Fox's Brett Baier 3 weeks ago, who ran through a laundry list of Vance's past comments.
You've said, I'm a never Trump guy, never liked him. Terrible candidate, idiot if you voted for him, might be America's Hitler, might be a cynical a-hole, cultural heroin, noxious and reprehensible. How do you deal with them now?
Yeah, well, I think the simple answer is you've got to respect the American people enough to just level with them. Look, I was wrong about Donald Trump. I didn't think he was going to be a good president, Brett. He was a great president, and it's one of the reasons why I'm working so hard to make sure he gets a second term.
We're going to talk about J.D. Vance's evolution from never Trump white working class whisperer to heir to the MAGA throne now with Christopher Devine, political scientist at the University of Dayton, not far from where Vance grew up in Middletown, Ohio. And Devine is also the author of the book Do Running Mates Matter? The Influence of Vice Presidential Candidates in Presidential Elections. Welcome to Press Play, Chris.
Thank you, Madeline. So I'm glad to be on today.
Great to have you. Okay, so you've been a longtime J.D. Vance watcher. What do you make of this pick?
You know, it's surprising and not surprising. I think in the context of this race, as we saw it shaping up, he made a lot of sense, given what I think Donald Trump was looking for. And I think his top priorities, we may get into more, you know, it's kind of this level of loyalty that I'm not even sure that word describes it. Someone who basically would say yes to Trump in a January 6th type of scenario where Mike Pence, who is otherwise very loyal to him, said no. He had some point he could reach where he would say no to Donald Trump. I think Trump wanted someone who was even more loyal than that, something that might be better described as fealty. That's what J.D. Vance has signaled for a long time that he would deliver. I think that was his main appeal. The surprising part is if we think of this in a broader context, I mean, here we have a guy that, as you mentioned in the intro, it was only the beginning of last year that he began serving in his first political office. This is not the typical level of qualifications that we would expect from a VP. I would go so far as to say he's simply not well qualified, probably the least qualified vice presidential candidate that we've had in recent memory. And yes, I'm including Sarah Palin as well as John Edwards, two of the other less qualified candidates of recent times. In that statement.
Really? And that's because he's only been in office for a year and a half. But we, you know, Barack Obama wasn't in the Senate for a full term before he was elected either.
Right. He was in there for 4 years. He had previously served in the state legislature. So he had about a decade of experience. I don't think that's ideal for a presidential or vice presidential candidate. But also in that case, he was chosen by voters in the Democratic Party. This was a choice of one man, Donald Trump, who easily could have picked pretty much anybody else in the Republican Party. And we even saw on his finalist list, whether it was the eight that came out about a month ago or the other two alongside Vance, Marco Rubio and Doug Burgum, who were in consideration at the end. Both those gentlemen were extremely well qualified, I would say. Any of them would have been a better pick for someone who could be not just vice president, but, you know, an unfortunate turn of events, could become president just 6 months from now.
Well, Donald Trump himself didn't have any qualifications before he won and was president. So I guess that's not high on his list of priorities. What is high on his list of priorities besides absolute loyalty?
So, you know, I think what we've seen from Donald Trump over time, including in this campaign, is real commitment to the base of his party, doubling down on the MAGA agenda, set of issues that he's had over time. Very strict immigration policy, for example, socially conservative, other things that we've seen from him. And J.D. Vance reinforces those policy views. I don't think that's any way a bad thing by itself. I think it's nice to have a president and vice president who are fairly well aligned on the issues. Then again, it helps to have some diversity of perspectives. And there's little indication that J.D. Vance would push Donald Trump to maybe reconsider some of his policies. It seems more likely that he's going to really, you know, support him no matter what, as a way of making sure that he retains Trump's support. As he said in the clip that you played there, Trump is essentially responsible for him becoming a senator, first winning a tough primary, but then the general election in 2022. It's very clear that Donald Trump basically made J.D. Vance's career. He's doing that again here. Vance is going to owe him a lot, and it makes you question whether he's going to be willing to say some hard things to Trump if circumstances warrant.
Yeah. Let me play another clip of J.D. Vance, and this is from his interview with Terry Gross on Fresh Air during the 2016 book tour for Hillbilly Elegy. And she asked him back then who would earn his vote.
If I feel like Trump has a really good chance of winning, that I might have to hold my nose and vote for Hillary Clinton. But at the end of the day, I just feel like she is so culturally disconnected from the people that I grew up around that it would be very, very hard for me to cast my ballot for her. So ultimately, I think I'll probably vote third party because I can't stomach Trump. I think that he's noxious and is leading the white working class to a very dark place.
Okay, so obviously he's had quite a turnabout. How do you account for that? I mean, he said sort of glibly, now I see that he was a great president. But how did he change his view on who Trump essentially is and what he wants?
Well, we heard his explanation earlier. J.D. Vance says basically that he was persuaded by Donald Trump that he was he resisted him at the beginning and then saw what he did in office and was inspired by that and just realized he was wrong and has the courage now to just say that plainly and, admit his error and support Donald Trump. There are a lot of folks who are skeptical of that. I'm one of them. It sounded more like the real J.D. Vance speaking back then, in my opinion. Could be wrong. But the other explanation would be that this is someone who, kind of tried out that line of thinking for a few years, had the ambition to run for political office, was going to do so as a Republican. He's generally a conservative guy, and saw after 2016, not only when Trump won, but as he continued to gain popularity within the Republican Party, I think J.D. Vance saw that the only path to elected office as a Republican, especially if you were going to go fairly high, perhaps even pursue the presidency, was to support Donald Trump. He saw other people who, resisted Donald Trump within the Republican Party, who criticized him, and things didn't turn out well for them. They lost primaries or they failed to get elected. My guess is that he saw that and concluded that his only hope to fulfill his ambitions was to support Donald Trump. And for that matter, to be a more outspoken, loyal supporter of Donald Trump than anyone else.
What are his ambitions? Do you think his ambitions are to run himself in 2028?
I assume that's the case. Yeah, there's no reason to believe that he would, decline that kind of an opportunity. Clearly, he's been angling for this for a while. He was very committed, I think, to the job interview process for VP. One of those, unlike, for example, Marco Rubio, who went up to the courthouse in New York to support Trump. Also, I think, has been auditioning in part through his communication, as we saw after the assassination attempt on Saturday, within, I think it was a couple hours, Vance was kind of escalating the rhetorical, performance there and blaming Joe Biden directly, he said, directly for the assassination attempt, which, of course, was absurd. At that point, among other things, we knew nothing about the shooter. And he's saying this. So I think it was this constant demonstration to Donald Trump that he would never back down. He would double down. And I think that's appealing to Donald Trump.
So should Donald Trump win re-election and J.D. Vance become the vice president, do you think that he would have an effect on the presidency? Do you think that he would have a big voice and a big influence on Donald Trump? How do you think he would be seen and how much power would he have?
Good question. You know, vice presidents get mocked for being unimportant. Of course, we pay attention to a lot around the time of the VP pick. But otherwise, we hear a lot of jokes about vice presidents. We see silly characters like in Veep and in other pop culture representations. But the reality is that vice presidents, although they have very little in the way of constitutional power, They have a lot of informal power. They're major players in most administrations, not because of law dictating that, but because presidents over time, really starting with Jimmy Carter and Walter Mondale in the 1970s, realized that the vice president can be a tremendous asset to the president. Top advisor, the last person in the room, as it's often described. The president doesn't always listen to the vice president. Joe Biden found that out, advising Barack Obama, for example, and not getting the policy he wanted, let's say, on Afghanistan. But vice presidents tend to be very powerful. With that said, Donald Trump's vice president won't necessarily be powerful. We can see that in Mike Pence, who was told that he'd be the most consequential vice president ever when Trump was selecting him. That was part of their private conversation. But in fact, we saw him have very little influence. Sometimes he had impressive titles, heading the COVID task force, for example. But did he actually change Donald Trump's mind on anything? There's very little evidence of that. So J.D. Vance might find himself in the same place where his best bet for staying in Donald Trump's good graces is supporting him, whatever may come up. He may decide to challenge him and see if he can change his thinking, but I'm not sure he'll have much success in exerting any real independent influence in the White House. But we'll see.
All right. So he opposes abortion rights, even in the case of incest or rape, but says there should be exceptions for cases when the mother's life is in danger. He is very much America first. He opposes funding the war in Ukraine. He opposes funding for Ukraine. And he is all for building a wall on the southern border and does not want to grant amnesty to any immigrants who have come here illegally. So he's pretty conservative and pretty populist. And so how will that work on the campaign trail? Is that going to attract more voters, shore up the base? What do you think?
Yeah, I do think he will shore up the base. You know, the trend, I can say, even just broadly looking at the data on vice presidential candidates, we've seen in recent years that tends to be that the party of the presidential candidate loves that person. The other party can't stand them. And then independents, folks in the middle, are less than impressed. So, for example, the last time around, Mike Pence and Kamala Harris were the most popular VP candidates on record within their own party, but also not very popular broadly within the electorate going beyond their party. So J.D. Vance, I think, like most recent vice presidential candidates, will be wildly popular among Republicans. And for that matter, he is someone who really plays to the base of the party. I think they'll love him. Outside the party, I don't think he'll impress people that much. I think Democrats, based on policy concerns or rhetoric or a variety of things, will see Vance as not just a bad but a dangerous candidate. For those voters who are maybe in the middle on some of the policy matters, I think they'll see in him someone who is very partisan in his rhetoric and someone who is not well qualified for office. And so I don't think they'll be particularly impressed. So this is a pick that I think I don't think it was done for strategic reasons. I think it's more for governing. I think it's more for loyalty once in office, again, to say yes when Mike Pence one time said no. But there is a campaign element. I think that is to reassure the base of the party that Trump is still their champion and he's not backing down one inch.
Right. And so how does that change the Democrats' calculus in a few seconds?
Democrats are still figuring a lot of things out right now.
Yeah.
Assuming Joe Biden's the candidate, it looks increasingly likely. He's not going to change his VP pick, but they may want to focus on J.D. Vance to make broader arguments about Donald Trump, you know, being too conservative on policy, but also perhaps being dangerous in terms of the future of American democracy.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's Christopher Devine, political scientist at the University of Dayton in Ohio and author of the book Do Running Mates Matter? The Influence of Vice Presidential Candidates in Presidential Elections. Coming up, we'll check in on the Democrats. Is there still a move brewing to get Joe Biden to leave the race? Later on, the director of a new documentary on the comedian Louis C.K. about what happened after he was in Me Too disgrace. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Let's check in on the Democrats now. When we left off, before the shooting, before the bloody ear fist pump photo, before this week's RNC exuberance, the story was whether President Biden should remain at the top of the Democratic ticket. Biden tried again to quiet the party panic in an interview with NBC's Lester Holt yesterday.
Do you feel like you've weathered the storm on this issue of whether you should be on the ticket or not?
Look, 14 million people voted for me to be the nominee in the Democratic Party. Okay? I listen to them.
But there are still concerns that Biden can win. Joining us to talk about this is Sahil Kapoor, senior national political reporter for NBC News. Welcome.
Great to join you.
Well, obviously, in that interview, Biden has not changed his stance. And have Democrats, after this weekend's events, after the opening of the RNC, have they, Democrats who were skeptical of him at the top of the ticket, have they changed their opinion?
Not exactly. There is no Democrat that I can think of who was skeptical or opposed to President Biden staying in who has changed their mind. What is also true is that the dam has not quite broken within the Democratic Party. The dam is largely held. There are a few dozen prominent Democrats who have come out and asked them to step aside, but there are many, many more who have not done that. Now, the key group here is the quiet skeptics. There are a lot of lawmakers, Democratic lawmakers on Capitol Hill, Democratic candidates who we've talked to, who have told us privately that they don't want President Biden to stay in the race as a candidate, that he's likely to lose to Donald Trump in their view, that he's also likely to be a drag on the Democratic ticket and bring down Senate and House candidates. But they have not spoken about this publicly for a whole variety of reasons. And this group, you know, has not changed their quiet skepticism, as I'd call it, in recent days. And the president has been emphatic that he's staying. So at this moment, he doesn't feel like he's getting pushed out.
So at this moment, we're sort of at an impasse. We don't know which way the party's going to go.
I would call it a moment of purgatory for the Democratic Party. There's still a lot of unease. The chapter is not closed for many members, you know, especially in light of recent days, the assassination attempt on Donald Trump. They don't feel like the oxygen is there for them to wage this battle publicly, at least the public skeptics who have been trying to rally more Democrats to their side. The fact that the focus has moved firstly on that horrific incident at that Trump rally and now on the RNC, the Republican convention this weekend, makes it harder for Democrats to make their case.
When you talk about the quiet skeptics, if you could put a number on it or a percentage, how big a portion of the Democratic establishment is that, the quiet skeptics?
It's hard to do. That's a good question. At least dozens more. Let's just say it's much bigger than the public skeptics or the public opponents of Joe Biden staying in. I would say probably more than half the party is at least skeptical, if not opposed, to Joe Biden staying in the race. And I would say when I say the party, I'm talking about Democratic members of Congress. That's where I would put the number.
Right. And is one of those quiet skeptics California Congressman and Senate candidate Adam Schiff? Because the New York Times is reporting that at a private fundraiser, he reportedly said that his party was likely to suffer overwhelming losses in November in the House and Senate if Biden remains at the top of the ticket. So is he one of the quiet skeptics? And if so, that would be a big name who's not in favor.
The Schiff has done, at least publicly, what a number of Democrats have done, which is to plead with President Biden to seriously reconsider his position in the race, but stopping just short of calling on him to step aside. He sort of hinted at this in a recent interview on NBC's Meet the Press, suggesting that the president should give a serious look to whether he can beat Donald Trump and making clear that he believes Vice President Kamala Harris, should she be elevated to the top of the ticket, has a better chance at defeating Trump. Now, if you read between the lines, it's not difficult to figure out what he's saying, but we don't know what exactly Schiff did or didn't say at that fundraiser, so I don't want to speak to that reporting, but it does track with the fact that Schiff has been openly, at least somewhat skeptical, if not an outright opponent of Biden staying in.
Okay, so why the... I guess I don't want to say timidity, but why all the quiet skepticism? Why don't people come right out and say it if they don't think that he can win or that he's going to be a drag on the party? What's holding them back from saying it publicly and forthrightly?
So this is an important question that I've been trying to figure out as well. And I got my answer more or less when I paid a visit to Michigan and went to that Detroit rally that Joe Biden held last Friday. I talked to a lot of Democratic voters at that rally. And they're angry or disappointed with the Democrats who have called on President Biden to step aside. They don't want him to go. There's still a lot of passion within the Democratic grassroots for Joe Biden staying in the race. And one thing I picked up talking to voters at that rally was this desire for the Democratic coalition to stay unified, to not show any divisions, not show any cracks. They believe that simply plays into Donald Trump's hand. One voter, in fact, told me that Democrats should be a little bit more like Republicans in this case, to be more loyal to their nominee and stop the infighting. So that's what candidates, including in swing districts and in battleground Senate races, like, for instance, Elissa Slotkin of Michigan, who did not go to that rally. This is the kind of voter that they absolutely have to win over, that they can't afford to alienate or diminish enthusiasm among these Democratic voters if they are to win. So that's the balance that, you know, swing district, swing state Democrats are striking. They need to hold the base together, and a lot of the base still likes Joe Biden. And then for the, you know, for those in blue states, blue districts, there are even more of them in their coalition. They're, you know, more solidly Democratic constituencies. You would be angering a lot of them to speak out. So it's just a fear of their voters for the
Interesting.
Most part.
And you do see a lot of progressive lawmakers standing by his side. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Pramila Jayapal, Bernie Sanders on NPR today making the case for Joe Biden staying at the top of the ticket, as opposed to some of the more centrist members who are more skeptical.
Yes, and this is strategic. I've talked to Congresswoman AOC about this, and a few days after that shocking debate performance by President Biden, she said she had an extensive conversation with the president and remained strongly supportive of him. And what she and Senator Bernie Sanders and other progressives are trying to do is use this moment as an opportunity to try to nudge President Biden toward their economic vision. There's a lot of things that they want him to do that he has not done yet. For instance, come out for expanding Social Security benefits. Joe Biden just did that a few days ago. You know, he put out this morning, he put out a sweeping new policy plan to reduce the cost of rent. This is something that progressives have been pushing for a long time. So they've decided to be strategic about this moment rather than take part in the intra-party infighting, to use this moment, believing that Joe Biden is still going to stay at the top of the ticket, use it to try to get their agenda items more into the spotlight.
When is it going to be really impossible for them to change if they wanted to change who's at the top of the ticket and bring in, I don't know, Vice President Harris or whoever else rises to the top? When is there a due date where they have to make a decision?
Everyone you talk to would have a different idea about this. I think it's fair to say that every day that goes by makes it harder. You know, we're only 100 and some days away from Election Day, and this would already be historically late in the process to even consider changing a nominee. So put that aside. This is RNC convention week. The next week, Congress is back. I would say next week is going to be a crucial week. If next week goes by and there's no meaningful movement, there's no either dam break or major trickle of other Democrats trying to push the president aside, then it's going to be very, very difficult to do, especially if the DNC continues with its current plans to nominate Joe Biden by a virtual roll call vote ahead of the August convention. There was some talk of them doing that, although, you know, some people say this is no longer necessary because the reason to do that was an Ohio deadline that's now been extended. So there's some unease over the DNC's plans there. That could be another artificial deadline that Democrats might set. If they officially nominate him, there is nothing really that can be done.
Right. And so what is it that would break the dam? Would it be another disastrous public performance or what? Are they just waiting for something to happen?
I think the other thing that I've heard is from some Democrats directly is they're watching their polls. They're watching to see in their home district, their home states, if the bottom is falling out or the coalition is holding together. Now, this is complicated because, again, this is why Democrats are stuck in this state of purgatory. The polls have worsened a little bit for President Biden, but not massively. He's down a few points from where he was, the day before the debate in the polling averages. That is not necessarily enough for Democrats to say the dam has broken, we need to flip the table and find a new nominee. And there's also, by the way, coloring this entire conversation is the prospect of elevating Vice President Harris to the top of the ticket. There's a ton of, nervousness among Democrats as to whether she would be any better. Democrats tend to be very risk averse, especially in the era of Trump. And unless they feel broadly convinced that Kamala Harris will do better than Joe Biden at the top of the ticket, there is a decent chance that the dam might hold just because of that.
Sahil Kapoor is senior national political reporter for NBC News. Sahil, thank you.
Thanks, Madeline.
Coming up, we will revisit the Louis C.K. story.
There was one story where he had taken off his clothes in a hotel room, and a lot of people were asking, well, why didn't they just leave the room?
How he was disgraced and how he came back, next on Press Play. This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. With a warning about this next interview, we're going to be talking about sexual misconduct, which may have some graphic content which you or any children within ear range might not want to hear. Okay. In 2017, at the height of the Me Too movement, comedian Louis C.K.'s career imploded.
Breaking tonight, five women are accusing comedian Louis C.K. of sexual misconduct in a bombshell report from the New York Times.
Women say that the comedian would make sexually inappropriate comments. Some say he also masturbated in front of them.
Three more women report similar incidents.
Some of the women say they feared career repercussions if they spoke out.
News this morning about the comedian Louis C.K., who has come out to say that the accusations against him are in fact true.
A New York Times expose detailed sexual misconduct allegations from five women. Louis C.K. admitted the stories were true. He expressed remorse and said he would step back and take a long time to listen and learn. Then, 9 months later, he returned to the stage.
All right, you want to talk about it? Should we talk about it?
Yeah, all right. I don't mind talking about it.
If you ever ask somebody, may I jerk off in front of you? And they say yes. Just say, are you sure?
That's the first part. And then if they say yes, just don't do it.
So what does his comeback say about how we view celebrities who've done bad things? Where's the line? Who draws it? And for whom? These questions are explored in the new documentary, Sorry, Not Sorry, produced by The New York Times. And joining me now is the co-director, Caroline Sue. Hi, Caroline.
Hello. Thank you for having us.
Great to have you. And one of the women in the movie is here, too, comedian and writer Megan Keister. She was an up-and-coming comedian who tried to blow the whistle on what was pretty much an open secret before the Times story. Hi, Megan.
Hello. Nice to talk to you.
Nice to have you both. All right, Caroline, let's begin with you and give us the quick rundown on how Louis C.K. became Louis C.K.
I was a big fan of Louis, so I kind of watched his rise as a fan. He was able to kind of speak honestly and seemingly candidly about, you know, his own kind of foibles and faults, and also what it was like to be a parent, you know, and generally what it was like to be a flawed human being in a way that people could relate to. He seemed to be particularly insightful and able to take kind of complex things in life and turn it into very insightful comedy.
Yeah, he was very much beloved because it seemed like he had an ability to see through things that we normal human beings, as you say, with all our foibles, couldn't really put a finger on, but he did. And we could say, oh, yeah, that's me. I'm a little ashamed that I think this way, too, but I'm glad someone's talking about it in public. And Megan, what did you think of his comedy?
I hate to be that kind of person, but I never liked it from the outset. But I don't have a wife or kids, so maybe it wasn't relatable to me.
Gotcha. All right. Well, let's listen to one of the jokes from his show.
How do women still go out with guys when you consider the fact that there is no greater threat to women than men? We're the number one threat.
All right, Caroline, you put that in the movie, and obviously to make a point. And looking back on it now, you can kind of raise your eyebrows and say, was he saying the quiet part out loud all the time? What do you make of that? Also, that he made a lot of jokes on stage about jerking off, as we heard earlier.
Yeah, I mean, I think in hindsight, it seems like maybe he was trying to tell everyone something. I don't know what was in his mind that made him go there. But, you know, like most comedians, I mean, Megan can speak to this better than I can. It's about transgression and kind of using your own life as material to talk about.
Right, but wasn't he also seen as kind of a feminist in a way, like defending women? And he was a great promoter of Pamela Adlon's show, for example, Better Things, about a single mom trying to raise three daughters. So he was seen as someone who was enlightened when it came to women, at least publicly.
You can publicly be a feminist, I guess, but also privately be a sex pest. I think there's a lot of men that actually hide behind that sort of like male feminist banner while they're privately doing horrific things. There weren't just a few isolated incidents of him being acting in a sexually improprietous manner. I mean, he had been doing it for, I mean, frankly, decades. He didn't make a mistake. He already didn't, you know, respect women enough to care from the outset.
Right.
I mean, that's something that Tig Notaro brings up, that, you know, that maybe he helped her and he helped all these women's careers as a kind of distraction or cover for what he was doing in his private life. The film kind of tries to shy away from any sort of speculation about what was going on in his mind, because at the end of the day, we really don't know. But we just tried to lay out, you know, the facts kind of what happened as a way of understanding the story.
Megan, you were not a victim, per se, of Louis C.K. He didn't
never did it
ask
to me.
If he could masturbate in front of you. So what is your connection to this story?
My connection to the story is as a female comedian who has also experienced assault at the hands of another comedian and been friends with other female comedians who have experienced assault at the hands of male comedians, and no one caring. If I knew that he had been doing this stuff, and I was basically an open micer when I found out, then everyone has to know it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
He'd been doing it for years and nobody had done
anything. When you say open micer, it means you just go up on stage and open mic.
Yeah, like an amateur comedian. Yeah. Like a couple years in it.
So then you tried to make it public at this big comedy festival, Just for Laughs. And what happened?
When I went to Just for Laughs, I was going there on behalf, I was going to write about it for Gawker. And so what I did when I was there is I went to like the red carpet event for one of their galas, and I was just asking. I asked every comedian, like, how do you feel about the Cosby allegations? Because that was something, that was a story that was trending at the time. And then I would follow it up with, how do you feel about the Louis allegations? And everyone I asked acted as though they were aghast. They had never heard anything like that in their entire lives. After I'd asked Kevin Hart that question, the COO yelled at me and told me that Louis C.K. was, you know, part of the Just for Laughs family. I was on their turf. And so if I were to continue with that line of inquiry, I would be ejected.
And so then you did publish these allegations on your own personal website.
When I put it on my website, I used to write for Vice. And when I put it on my website, people started reading it and it got traction. So Vice reran it. And essentially what happened after that, because this was in the period before the New York Times article came out, the only thing that really happened after that was just a bunch of men on the internet said that I was the C word and that I was jealous and I was talentless.
So, Caroline, these allegations, as Megan said, they've been around for decades, and she exposed them on her website and in Vice. And then finally it breaks wide open in the New York Times. What's the reaction?
You know, I think immediately some people were asking if it was that bad. You know, there was one story where he had taken off his clothes in a hotel room in front of two female comedians during a comedy festival and masturbated. And a lot of people were asking, well, why didn't they just leave the room? There was one instance where he masturbated on the phone with someone who was in the film, and a lot of people, including Dave Chappelle, were asking, oh, why didn't you hang up the phone? And I can't say I didn't have those same questions also, but I realized kind of I had a gut feeling that I was not asking the right questions. And so that was really the inspiration for making the film, is trying to get my head around the story and understand how to navigate through it.
Was it hard to get the women who accused him to talk to you?
You know, we had conversations, at least with some of them. I had conversations over months, maybe even years, just talking to them about the film and wanting to make the film. And understandably, Dan and Julia, who were in the Aspen hotel room, they're focused on their career. And I think they've had enough. They don't want to talk about this. There was like terrible blowback to their careers. They just wanted to not focus on this anymore or be the focus of the story.
Yeah. Well, a day after the story came out, he responded in a written statement and he says, yes, the stories are true. And he thought what he did was okay because he had asked first. And then he says, and I just want to quote from his statement, but what I learned later in life, too late, is that when you have power over another person, asking them to look at your member isn't a question, it's a predicament for them. The power I had over these women is that they admired me and I wielded that power irresponsibly. There is nothing about this that I forgive myself for, and I have to reconcile it with who I am, which is nothing compared to the task I left with them. And it goes on. So this is one of the rare times when one of the public men in the spotlight actually expresses such full-throated remorse. What did you make of that response?
At the time, I thought, oh, gee whiz, good job. What the problem is that, you know, time passed and it didn't really seem like he grew or learned anything.
I agree with Megan. And in the course of making the film, we realized that when he comes back, first of all, he said that there was that he asked for consent. He goes on to kind of describe what happened as his kind of sexual kink, and rather than this imbalance of power. So he kind of backtracks his position in his comedy. And actually more than one person has pointed out that in that quote unquote apology, he never says the word sorry.
Right. And he entitles his comeback tour, his comedy tour, Sorry. Did you see that as kind of a thumb in the eye?
Yes. I mean, I was actually at that show in the small, in the Madison Square Garden, in the smaller theater. And when he came out on stage, they revealed that Starry sign in, I don't know, 12-foot red lights across the stage. And it did seem like a kind of slap in the face. So it was really, I was so surprised when I saw that sitting in the audience.
I guess the bigger question that all of this raises now many years later is, when can someone come back? And when do we forgive them? Do we forgive them? What do they need to do in order to be forgiven? Let me just play a clip of tape from the comedian Michael Ian Black, who is in your movie and is quite thoughtful in examining this kind of question. And he had sent a tweet saying people have to be allowed to, quote, serve their time and move on with their lives. And this is what he says.
There's going to be other men who experience these problems. And what is the path forward? And I was like, I'm not defending Louis's actions. I'm having in public a conversation that I feel like men are having in private.
And also in public, I guess, men are having in public, very, very much in public. And I'm wondering where you two fall on this question. And let's begin with you, Megan.
I would say I'm more interested in what's the path forward for the women whose lives and careers were ruined by the actions of other entertainers. There's a lot of talk mm-hmm. about rehabilitation of the man himself, but there's not much talk about, you know, the networks that suppressed these women's voices for years. There's not a lot of talk about careers being destroyed. When it comes to Louis, I mean, it's like I said, like, if he was genuinely contrite and thoughtful, you can't forgive someone unless they, you know, have done something to deserve it.
So you don't think he should be back on stage? I mean, he's back and selling out shows like at the Garden and elsewhere and making lots of money.
He is, but now he has an entirely different demographic of people that enjoy him. Now it seems like the majority of his fan base are people that don't just like him in spite of what he did. They like him because of what he did. Mm. He's very popular amongst, like, you know, the alt-right sort of contingency. And so now he just basically has to play to these mouth breathers. And honestly, I think that for a guy like Louis, that is a fate worse than jail.
Caroline?
You know, those questions were kind of the reason I wanted to make the film is, you know, like, oh, when does someone come back? Are they ever supposed to, I mean, are they supposed to become wards of the state? Can they ever apply their craft again? You know, a lot of people talk about cancel culture and was Louis canceled or was he not canceled? But when you get into it, you realize that the women who came forward in the Times article, like, they were canceled before they even had a chance to get going in some cases because they were shut down as soon as they just simply, when asked, said what happened to them. You know, I have no, if he wants to perform and if people want to pay money to see him, you know, by all means, that's their right. I mean, there's certainly artists who I have that, you know, issue with, who I, where I might listen to music, even though I know the person was very problematic. But the movie is an attempt to get people to, you know, if you haven't, to kind of think about it in a kind of hearty way. You know, where do I draw the line, and what am I doing when I buy tickets to a show, or when I buy an album or listen to music on the radio? You know, what's my part in it? So it's kind of asking the audience, including myself, what are you supposed to do? How are you supposed to engage with it when you know the facts?
Like, would you go to a Louis show now, or would you watch a TV show that he made now?
It's become tainted, so I can't enjoy it in the same way.
Mm. Well, I want to thank you both for coming on the show today.
Thanks, Madeline.
Thank you.
That's Megan Keister and Caroline Sue. Megan is in the new documentary, Sorry Not Sorry, and Caroline is the director. Coming up, will Olympians swim in the Seine in Paris? We'll talk to an American who dared to do it himself next on Press Play. This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The Paris Olympics begin in 10 days, and two often unsung events are getting a lot of attention: marathon and triathlon swimming. Not so much because of the competition, but because of the setting. Swimmers are set to dive into Paris's famous Seine River. The French have spent nearly $1.5 billion cleaning it up, but recent testing still shows dangerous levels of E. coli bacteria. And some people are concerned about submerging in a river that has long functioned as a sewer. One American, though, living in Paris, was tired of waiting around, and he jumped in. Joel Strati McClure is a 75-year-old U.S. master swimmer based in Paris who lived to tell the tale of his recent dip. Welcome to the program.
Madeline, great to be with you.
Great to have you. Okay, so you went in on the 4th of July. You held up an American flag. What was the inspiration? Why did you jump in? It's illegal, I might add, to swim in the Seine.
It's illegal, but I swam in the same place I swam on the 4th of July 48 years ago for the cover of a magazine called the Paris Metro. I was diving, trying to find a gargoyle that apparently fell in the river when they were constructing Notre Dame. I found a boot, and that inspired me to come back 48 years later to see if I could perhaps find the gargoyle. I was also very upset because the president of France and the mayor of Paris had both promised to swim in the Seine to show that the water was clean and safe and the events would take place. They missed their deadline on the 23rd of June. They missed another deadline on the 29th of June. And I decided to invite the mayor to join me on the 4th of July to come in the water. We're not talking a serious Cuba to Florida swim here. We're talking a dive in a river, something that can be accomplished very quickly. She did not respond to my invitation, so I went in by myself to simply lower the tone a notch and show people that this is not a very difficult thing to do. It is illegal, and I was a little concerned about getting arrested. There apparently are lots of E. coli. I didn't see any. I'm not sure what an E. coli looks like, but I swam. I'm well. I'm fine. I went to a water park with my grandchildren a couple days later. I was more concerned about picking up stuff from all the people in the water park than from getting something in the river.
However, the river waters have been tested and they still have dangerously high levels of E. coli. You may have not gotten sick, but you really weren't in the water that long. You swam, what, 300-400 yards?
Yeah, but on the day that I swam, positive tests came out showing that the level was at an acceptable rate and had been for a week. The level goes up and down. Obviously, on the day that the events are scheduled in the Olympics, if it's unsafe, they should not hold the events. But in fact, it has been safe more than it's been unsafe during the past 3 weeks.
So you think that all of this talk about danger is overblown and that the Olympic events that are supposed to be held in the Seine should be held and full steam ahead?
No, I don't think they should be held if there's any concern about the water level being a damage to possible swimmers. That would be idiotic. But what I do find is that the fact that the president and mayor of Paris failed to swim as they stated they would do has created a lot of tension, nervousness. The swimmers don't know what's going on. The public doesn't know what's going on. The organizers don't know what's going on. I just wanted to bring the tone down to a realistic level. Since I swam, the Minister of Sports went in last Saturday, and she swam with a wetsuit. I swam only with a Speedo and generated a little bit of promotion and publicity about the event. And today, I believe most people think the events will possibly take place in the river. If on that day, 2 weeks from now, 10 days from now, the river is unhealthy, obviously the event should not be held. Mm-hmm. But that requires tests on that day, conversations between the Olympics Committee and the national teams.
Can you see the day, and would you like to see the day, when the Seine becomes a place where anyone can jump in and it's clean and it's just a great place to go take a dip?
Well, in 1900, when the Olympics were held here, the Summer Olympics were held here, people did swim in the Seine. There was competition in the Seine. And in 1923, they banned swimming. It's still illegal. I would definitely like to see people going in the Seine, not only the mayor and the president and myself, but everyone. They've had a thing during the past decade or so called Paris Plage, where they turn the banks of the Seine into a beach, by their definition, obviously an urban beach. And it would be great if those people could get in the water. Random swimmers do occasionally get in the water. And I have to admit that when I was swimming the other day, I didn't see any dead bodies. I didn't see any raw sewage, partly because the water is very murky. But I think it's murky because there's been an inordinate amount of rain, and that's brought sediment down the river. I was not worried when I got in. I didn't get arrested. I didn't get sick. So I'm a fan of trying to hold the events in the river, unless there are concerns for health. The mayor of Paris is finally going to go in tomorrow, the 17th of July, almost a month after she originally created all this tension by not swimming. And we'll see what she has to say about it.
Would you go in with her?
She's not speaking to me, so I probably won't. And you know what I found interesting is there are police all over Paris these days. It's a very high level of security and worry about the Olympics. When I swam on the 4th, there were no police in this area, which I found odd. I kind of felt like maybe the city hall had given me a carte blanche to do that swim and didn't want to confuse things by arresting me. Obviously, it would be counterproductive to throw a swimmer out of the river now. You want to do everything you can to promote it. But the fault is the French presidents and the mayor of Paris. They, by saying, you know, by canceling their swims, and even the French president called a snap election, and I think he called it just to avoid swimming, because the sensible president would not have called that election. Had he swum on June 15th, and had he done it with a bit of flair, popularizing the Olympics, the $1.5 billion river cleanup, the fact that they'd made all this progress in preparing for the games, he would have been in very solid political shape. By canceling that swim, he got into a little bit of political trouble. He's very unpopular anyway, but I guarantee you that had he done that swim in June, he'd be in better shape than he is today.
Well, Joel, sounds like you're in good shape and you're no worse for the wear for jumping in the Seine. So that's good.
Thank you very much, Madeline.
Thank you for joining us. That's Joel Strati McClure, freelance journalist, 75-year-old swimmer who dared to jump in the Seine. Tomorrow on Press Play, a conversation with writer Taffy Brodesser Ackner, author of Fleischman is in Trouble. She has a new novel out. It's called Long Island Compromise. in which she examines how being rich affects the grown-up kids in one family. It's also about how their dad's kidnapping traumatized the kids, even decades later. So she'll be with us tomorrow right here on Press Play. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Madeline Brand, and yeah, I'll see you tomorrow.
Support comes from Toast, a refreshing alcohol-free beverage to pair with food and meaningful moments where you'd normally find alcohol. With a high-quality blend of natural ingredients and a sophisticated experience, Toast is delightfully flavorful but not too sweet. Toast, T-O-S-T, is available at area Sprouts Farmers Market locations.